said I. "But it must be endorsed by this Purvis. The bank guarantees the check account is good."
"What about these notes?"
I looked over the banknotes. They were brand new. I said, "They are not signed. They are no good unless they are signed."
"Can you not sign them?"
"They must be signed by Mr. Whelper, the president of the bank."
"Is it such a hard name to spell?"
"It is an unusual name, but it is not hard to spell. The name is printed right here. That is his signature, the printed signature of Monroe G.B. Whelper, the president of the Whelper Commercial Bank of Denison, Texas. That signature must be matched over here."
"I want you to sign them, and this check, too."
Naturally, I did not wish to use my education in this robber's service, and I hesitated. He said,
"I will box your ears until your head rings."
I said, "I have nothing to write with." He drew a cartridge from his belt and opened his Barlow knife again.
"This will answer. I will shave the lead down."
"They must be signed in ink." Greaser Bob said, "We can attend to it later, Ned. This matter will keep."
"We will attend to it now," replied the bandit chieftain. "You're the one that wanted to look at the mail. This paper is worth over $4,000 with a little writing. The girl can write. Hald, go to the trash pile and fetch me a good stout turkey feather, a dry one, a big tail feather."
Then he pulled the bullet out of the cartridge case with his snagged teeth and poured the black powder in the palm of his hand. He spit on it through the gap and stirred the glutinous mass about with a finger. Harold Parmalee brought back a handful of feathers, and Lucky Ned Pepper chose one and cut the tip off with his knife and reamed out the hole a little. He dipped the quill into the ink and printed "Ned" on his wrist in childish characters. He said,
"There, you see, that is my name, is it not?"
I said, "Yes, that is Ned." He handed me the feather.
"Now go to it."
A flat rock with one of the contracts laid on it was made to serve for a desk. It is not in me to do poor work where writing is concerned, and I toiled earnestly at making faithful copies of Mr. Whelper's signature. However, the makeshift pen and ink were not satisfactory. The writing jumped and spread wide and pinched thin. It looked as though it had been done with a stick. My thought was, who will believe that Mr. Whelper signs his banknotes with a stick? But the unlettered bandit chieftain knew little of the world of banking, except for such glimpses as he got over a gun sight, and he was pleased with the work. I signed and signed, using his palm for an inkwell. It was very tiring. As soon as I had finished one note, he would snatch it up and pass me another. He said,
"They are as good as gold, Bob. I will trade them at Colbert's."
Greaser Bob said,
"Nothing on paper is as good as gold. That is my belief."
"Well, that is how much a damned Mexican knows."
"He is every man to his own principles. Tell her to hurry along."
When the criminal task was completed, Lucky Ned Pepper put the notes and the check in the gray envelope and secured it in the saddle wallet. He said,
"Tom, we will see you tonight. Make yourself agreeable to this child. Little Carol will be here before you know it."
Then they departed the place, not riding their horses but leading them, as the hill was so steep and brushy. I was alone with Tom Chaney. He sat across the fire from me, my pistol in his waistband and the Henry rifle in his lap. His face was a brown study. I stirred up the fire a little and arranged some glowing coals around one of the cans of hot water. Chaney watched me. He said,
"What are you doing?"
I said, "I am heating some water so that I may wash this black off my hands."
"A little smut will not harm you."
"Yes, that is true, or else you and your chums would surely be dead.
I know it will not harm me, but I would rather have it off.
Don't provoke me. You will find yourself in that pit.
Lucky Ned Pepper has warned you that if you molest me in any way, he will not pay you. He means business, too.
I fear he has no idea of paying me. I believe he has left me, knowing I am sure to be caught when I leave on foot.
He promised he would meet you at the old place.
Keep still. I must now think over my position and how I may improve it.
What about my position? At least you have not been abandoned by a man who was paid and pledged to protect you.
You little busybody. What does your kind know of hardship and affliction? Now keep still while I think.
Are you thinking about the old place?
No, I am not thinking about the old place. Carol Parmalee or nobody else is coming up here with any horse. They are not going to the old place. I am not so easily fooled as some people might think.
I thought to ask him about the other gold piece, then checked myself, afraid that he might force me to give over the one I had recovered. I said, "What have you done with Papa's mare?" He gave no answer. I said, "If you will let me go now, I will keep silent as to your whereabouts for 2 days."
"I tell you I can do better than that," said he. "I can have your silence forever. I will not tell you again to hold your tongue."
The water was not boiling, but it had begun to steam a little, and I picked up the can with a rag and flung it at him, then took to my feet in frantic flight. Though caught by surprise, he managed to shield his face with his arms. He yelped and gave immediate pursuit. My desperate plan was to reach the trees. Once there, I thought to evade him and finally lose him by darting this way and that in the brush. It was not to be. Just as I came to the edge of the rock shelf, Chaney grabbed my coat from behind and pulled me up short. My thought was, I am certainly done for. Chaney was cursing me, and he struck me on the head with the pistol barrel. The blow made me see stars, and I concluded I was shot, not knowing the sensation caused by a bullet striking your head. My thoughts turned to my peaceful home in Arkansas, and my poor mother, who would be laid low by the news. First her husband, and now her oldest child, both gone in the space of 2 weeks, and dispatched by the same bloody hand. That was the direction of my thoughts. Suddenly I heard a familiar voice, and the words were hard with authority.
"Hands up, Chelmsford. Move quickly. It is all up with you. Have a care with that pistol."
It was LaBeef the Texan. He had come up the back way, on foot I supposed, as he was panting for breath. He was standing not 30 feet away with his wired-together rifle trained on Chaney. Chaney let go of my coat and dropped the pistol.
"Everything is against me," he said.
I recovered the pistol.
LaBeef said, "Are you hurt, Maddie?"
"I have a painful knot on my head," said I. He said to Chaney,
"I see you are bleeding." "It was this girl done it," said he. "I am shot in the ribs and bleeding again. It hurts when I cough."
I said, "Where is Rooster?" LaBeef said,
"He is down below watching the front door. Let us find a place where we can see. Move with care, Chelmsford."
We proceeded to the northwest corner of the rock shelf, skirting around the pit which had figured in Chaney's ugly threats. "Watch your step there," I cautioned the Texan. "Tom Chaney says there are deadly snakes at the bottom, having their winter sleep." From the far corner of the ledge, we had a clear prospect. The timbered slope dropped off sharply below us and led to a meadow. This meadow, level and open, was quite high itself, and at the other end there was a further descent leading down out of the winding stair mountains. No sooner had we taken up our vigil than we were rewarded with the sight of Lucky Ned Pepper and the other three bandits emerging from the trees into the meadow. There they mounted their horses and headed them west, away from us. They had hardly started their ride when a lone horseman came out of the brush at the western end of the field. The horse was walking, and the rider took him out to the middle of the open space and stopped, so as to block the passage of the four desperados. Yes, it was Rooster Cogburn. The bandits checked up and faced him from some 70 or 80 yards distance. Rooster had one of the Navy revolvers in his left hand, and he held the reins in his right hand. He said,
"Where is the girl, Ned?"
Lucky Ned Pepper said,
"She was in wonderful health when last I saw her. I cannot answer for her now."
"You will answer for her now," said Rooster. "Where is she?"
Labeef stood up and cupped his hands and shouted down,
"She is all right, Cogburn. I have Chelmsford as well. Make a run for it."
I confirmed the news by shouting,
"I'm fine, Rooster. We have Cheney. You must get away."
The bandits turned to look up at us, and no doubt they were surprised and not a little disconcerted by the interesting development. Rooster made no reply to us and gave no sign of leaving the place. Lucky Ned Pepper said,
"Well, Rooster, will you give us the road? We have business elsewhere."
Rooster said,
"Harold, I want you and your brother to stand clear. I have no interest in you today. Stand clear now, and you will not be hurt."
Harold Parmalee's answer was to crow like a rooster, and the brought a hearty laugh from his brother Farrell. Lucky Ned Pepper said,
"What is your intention? Do you think 1-on-4 is a dogfall?"
Rooster said,
"I mean to kill you in 1 minute, Ned, or see you hanged in Fort Smith at Judge Parker's convenience. Which will you have?"
Lucky Ned Pepper laughed. He said,
"I call that bold talk for a one-eyed fat man."
Rooster said,
"Feel your hand, you son of a bitch."
And he took the reins in his teeth and pulled the other saddle revolver and drove his spurs into the flanks of his strong horse Bow and charged directly at the bandits. It was a sight to see. He held the revolvers wide on either side of the head of his plunging steed. The four bandits accepted the challenge, and they likewise pulled their arms and charged their ponies ahead. It was some daring move on the part of the deputy marshal, whose manliness and grit I had doubted. No grit? Rooster Cogburn? Not much. Labeef instinctively brought his rifle up, but then he relaxed it and did not fire. I pulled at his coat, saying, "Shoot them." The Texan said,
"They are too far, and they are moving too fast."
I believe the bandits began firing their weapons first, although the din and smoke was of such a sudden general nature that I cannot be sure. I do know that the marshal rode for them in so determined and unwavering a course that the bandits broke their line ere he reached them and raced through them, his revolvers blazing, and he not aiming with the sights but only pointing the barrels and snapping his head from side to side to bring his good eye into play. Harold Parmalee was the first to go down. He flung his shotgun in the air and clutched at his neck and was thrown backwards over the rump of his horse. The original greaser, Bob, rode wider than the others, and he lay flat on his horse and escaped clear with his winnings. Farrell Parmalee was hit, and a moment later his horse went down with a broken leg, and Farrell was dashed violently forward to his death. We thought Rooster had come through the ordeal with no injury, but in fact he had caught several shotgun pellets in his face and shoulders, and his horse, Bow, was mortally struck. When Rooster attempted to rein up with his teeth and turned to resume the attack, the big horse fell to the side, and Rooster under him. The field now remained to one rider, and that was Lucky Ned Pepper. He wheeled his horse about. His left arm hung limp and useless, but he yet held a revolver in his right hand. He said,
"Well, Rooster, I am shot to pieces."
Rooster had lost his big revolvers in the fall, and he was struggling to pull his belt gun, which was trapped to the ground under the weight of horse and rider. Lucky Ned Pepper nudged his pony forward in a trot, and he bore down on the helpless officer. Labeef quickly stirred beside me and assumed a sitting position with the Sharps rifle, his elbows locked against his knees. He took only a second to draw a bead and fire the powerful gun. The ball flew to its mark like a marten to his gourd, and lucky Ned Pepper fell dead in the saddle. The horse reared, and the body of the bandit was thrown clear, and the horse fled in panic. The distance covered by Labeef's wonderful shot at the moving rider was over 600 yards. I am prepared to swear an affidavit to it.
"Hurrah!" I joyfully exclaimed. "Hurrah for the man from Texas! Some bully shot!"
Labeef was pleased with himself, and he reloaded his rifle. Now, the prisoner has an advantage over his keeper in this respect, that he is always thinking of escape and watching for opportunities, while the keeper does not constantly think of keeping him. Once his man is subdued, so the guard believes, little else is needed but the presence and threat of superior force. He thinks of happy things and allows his mind to wander. It is only natural. Were it otherwise, the keeper would be a prisoner of the prisoner. So it was that Labeef, and I too, was distracted for a dangerous moment in appreciation of the timely rifle shot that saved Rooster Cogburn's life. Tom Cheney, seizing the occasion, picked up a rock about the size of a new cooking pumpkin and broke Labeef's head with it. The Texan fell over with a groan of agony. I screamed and hastened to my feet and backed away, bringing my pistol to bear once again on Tom Cheney, who was scrambling after the Sharps rifle. Would the old Dragoon revolver fail me this time? I hoped it would not. I hurriedly cocked the hammer and pulled the trigger. The charge exploded and sent a lead ball of justice, too long delayed, into the criminal head of Tom Cheney. Yet I was not to taste the victory. The kick of the big pistol sent me reeling backward. I had forgotten about the pit behind me. Over the edge I went, then tumbling and bouncing against the irregular sides, and all the while I was grabbing wildly for something and finding nothing. I struck the bottom with a thump that fairly dazed me. The wind was knocked from my lungs, and I lay still for a moment until I had regained my breath. I was addled, and I had the fanciful notion that my spirit was floating out of my body, escaping through my mouth and nostrils. I had thought myself to be lying down, but when I made to get up, I found I was stuck upright in a small hole, the lower part of my body wedged in tight between mossy rocks. I was caught like a cork in a bottle. My right arm was pinned against my side, and I could not pull it free. When I tried to use my left hand to push myself out of the hole, I saw with a shock that the forearm was bent in an unnatural attitude. The arm was broken. There was little pain in the arm, only a kind of pins and needles numbness. The movement in my fingers was weak, and I had but little grasping power. I was reluctant to use the arm for leverage, fearing the pressure would worsen the fracture and bring on pain. It was cold and dark down there, though not totally dark. A slender column of sunshine came down from above and ended in a small pool of light some 3 or 4 feet away on the stone floor of the cavern. I looked up at the column and could see floating particles of dust stirred up by my fall. I saw on the rocks about me a few sticks and bits of paper and an old tobacco sack and splotches of grease where skillets had been emptied. I also saw the corner of a man's blue cotton shirt, the rest of it being obscured by shadow. There were no snakes about. Thank goodness for that. I summoned my strength and cried out, "Help! Labeef, can you hear me?" No word of reply came. I did not know if the Texan were alive or dead. All I heard was a low roaring of the wind above and dripping noises behind me, and some faint cheeps and squeaks. I could not identify the nature of the squeaks or locate their origin. I renewed my effort to break free, but the vigorous movement made me slip a bit farther down in the mossy hole. My thought was, this will not do. I stopped maneuvering lest I drop right through the hole to what depths of blackness I could only imagine. My legs swung free below, and my jeans were bunched up so that portions of bare leg were exposed. I felt something brush against one of my legs, and I thought, spider. I kicked and flailed my feet, and then I stopped when my body settled downward another inch or so. Now more squeaks, and it came to me there were bats in the cavern below. Bats were making the noise, and it had been a bat that attached himself to my leg. Yes, I had disturbed them. Their roosting place was below. This hole I now so effectively plugged was their opening to the outside. I had no unreasonable fear of bats, knowing them for timid little creatures, yet I knew them too for carriers of the dread hydrophobia, for which there was no specific. What would the bats do, come night and their time to fly, and they found their opening to the outer world closed off? Would they bite? If I struggled and kicked against them, I would surely shake myself through the hole, but I knew I had not the will to remain motionless and let them bite. Night. Was I to be here then till night? I must keep my head and guard against such thoughts. What of Labeef? And what had become of Rooster Cogburn? He had not appeared to be badly hurt in the fall of his horse, but how would he know I was down here? I did not like my situation. I thought to set fire to bits of cloth for a signal of smoke, but the idea was useless because I had no matches. Surely someone would come, perhaps Captain Finch. The news of the gunfight must get out and bring a party to investigate. Yes, the posse of marshals. The thing was to hold tight. Help was sure to come. At least there were no snakes. I settled on this course. I would give cries for help every 5 minutes, or as near on that interval as I could guess it to be. I called out at once, and was again mocked by the echo of my own voice, and by the wind, and the dripping of the cave water, and the squeaking of the bats. I told numbers to measure the time. It occupied my mind and gave me a sense of purpose and method. I had not counted far when my body slipped down appreciably, and with panic in my breast, I realized that the moss which gripped me in a tight seal was tearing loose. I looked about for something to hold to, broken arm or not, but my hand found only slick and featureless planes of rock I was going through. It was a matter now of time. Another lurch down, to the level of my right elbow. That bony knob served as a momentary check, but I could feel the moss giving way against it. A wedge. That was what I needed. Something to stuff in the hole with me to make the cork fit more snugly. Or a long stick to pass under my arm. I cast my eyes about for something suitable. The few sticks lying about were none of them long enough or stout enough for my purpose. If only I could reach the blue shirt. It would be just the thing for packing. I broke one stick, scratching and pulling at the shirt tail. With the second one, I managed to bring it within reach of my fingertips. Weakened as my hand was, I got a purchase on the cloth with thumb and finger and pulled it out of the dark. It was unexpectedly heavy. Something was attached to it. Suddenly I jerked my hand away as though from a hot stove. The something was the corpse of a man. Or, more properly, a skeleton. He was wearing the shirt. I did nothing for a minute, so frightful and astonishing was the discovery. I could see a good part of the remains, the head with patches of bright orange hair showing under a piece of rotted black hat, one shirt-sleeved arm, and that portion of the trunk from about the waist upwards. The shirt was buttoned in two or three places near the neck. I soon recovered my wits. I am falling. I need that shirt. These thoughts bore upon me with urgency. I had no stomach for the task ahead, but there was nothing else to be done in my desperate circumstances. My plan was to give the shirt a smart jerk in hopes of tearing it free from the skeleton. I will have that shirt. Thus I took hold of the garment again and snatched it toward me with such sharp force as I could muster. My arm seized up with a stab of pain, and I let go. After a little tingling, the pain subsided and gave way to a dull and tolerable ache. I examined the result of my effort. The buttons had torn free, and now the body was within reach. The shirt itself remained clothed about the shoulders and arm bones in a careless fashion. I saw, too, that the maneuver had exposed the poor man's rib cage. One more pull, and I would have the body close enough so that I could work the shirt free. As I made ready for the job, my eyes were attracted to something. Movement? Within the cavity formed by the curving gray ribs. I leaned over for a closer look. Snakes. A ball of snakes. I flung myself back, but of course there was no real retreat for me, imprisoned as I was in the mossy trap. I cannot accurately guess the number of rattlesnakes in the ball, as some were big, bigger than my arm, and others small, ranging down to the size of lead pencils, but I believe there were not fewer than 40. With trembling heart, I looked on as they writhed sluggishly about in the man's chest. I had disturbed their sleep in their curious winter quarters, and now, more or less conscious, they had begun to move and detach themselves from the tangle, falling this way and that. This, thought I, is a pretty fix. I desperately needed the shirt, but I did not wish to mess further with the snakes in order to have it. Even while I considered these things, I was settling and being drawn down to what? Perhaps a black and bottomless pool of water where the fish were white and had no eyes to see. I wondered if the snakes could bite in their present lethargic state. I thought they could not see well, if at all, but I observed, too, that the light and warmth of the sun had an invigorating effect on them. We kept two speckled king snakes in our corn crib to eat rats, and I was not afraid of them, Saul and little David, but I really knew nothing about snakes. Moccasins and rattlers were to be avoided if possible, and killed if there was a chopping hoe handy. That was all I knew about poisonous snakes. The ache in my broken arm grew worse. I felt some more of the binding moss give way against my right arm, and at the same time I saw that some of the snakes were crawling out through the man's ribs. Lord, help me! I set my teeth and took hold of the bony hand that stuck forth from the blue shirt sleeve. I gave a yank and pulled the man's arm clean away from the shoulder. A terrible thing to do, you say, but you will see that I now had something to work with. I studied the arm. Bits of cartilage held it together at the elbow joint. With some twisting, I managed to separate it at that place. I took the long bone of the upper arm and secured it under my armpit to serve as a cross member. This would keep me from plunging through the hole should I reach that point in my descent. It was quite a long bone, and, I hoped, a strong one. I was grateful to the poor man for being tall. What I had left now was the lower part, the two bones of the forearm and the hand and wrist, all of a piece. I grasped it at the elbow and proceeded to use it as a flail to keep the snakes at bay. "Here, get away," said I, slapping at them with the bony hand. "Get back, you." This was well enough, except that I perceived the agitation only caused them to be more active. In trying to keep them away, I was at the same time stirring them up. They moved very slowly, but there were so many I could not keep track of them all. Each blow I struck brought burning pain to my arm, and you can imagine these blows were not hard enough to kill the snakes. That was not my idea. My idea was to keep them back and prevent them from getting behind me. My striking range from left to right was something short of 180 degrees, and I knew if the rattlers got behind me, I would be in a fine pickle. I heard noises above. A shower of sand and pebbles came cascading down. "Help!" I cried out. "I am down here. I need help." My thought was, "Thank God. Someone has come. Soon I will be out of this hellish place." I saw drops of something spattering on a rock in front of me. It was blood. "Hurry up!" I yelled. "There are snakes and skeletons down here." A man's voice called down, saying,
"I warrant there'll be another one before spring. A little spindly one."
It was the voice of Tom Chaney. I had not yet made a good job of killing him. I supposed he was leaning over the edge and the blood was falling from his wounded head.
How do you like it?
He taunted.
Throw me a rope, Tom. You cannot be mean enough to leave me.
You say you don't like it?
Then I heard a shout and the sounds of a scuffle and a dreadful crunch, which was Rooster Cogburn's rifle stock smashing the wounded head of Tom Chaney. There followed a furious rush of rocks and dust. The light was blocked off, and I made out a large object hurtling down toward me. It was the body of Tom Chaney. I leaned back as far as I could to avoid being struck, and at that it was a near thing. He fell directly upon the skeleton, crushing the bones and filling my face and eyes with dirt and scattering the puzzled rattlesnakes every which way. They were all about me, and I commenced striking at them with such abandon that my body dropped free through the hole.
Gone.
No. Checked short. I was shakily suspended in space by the bone under my armpit. Bats flew up past my face, and the ones below were carrying on like a treeful of sparrows at sundown. Only my head and my left arm and shoulder now remained above the hole. I hung at an uncomfortable angle. The bone was bowed under my weight, and I prayed it would hold. My left arm was cramped and fully occupied in holding to it, and I had not the use of the hand in fending off the snakes.
Help! I called. I need help!
Rooster's voice came booming down, saying,
Are you all right?
No, I am in a bad way. Hurry up.
I am pitching down a rope. Fasten it under your arms and tie it with a good knot.
I cannot manage a rope. You will have to come down and help me. Hurry up, I am falling. There are snakes all about my head.
Hold on, hold on,
came another voice. It was Labeef. The Texan had survived the blow. The officers were both safe. I watched as two rattlers struck and sunk their sharp teeth into Tom Chaney's face and neck. The body was lifeless and made no protest. My thought was, those scoundrels can bite in December, and right there is the proof of it. One of the smaller snakes approached my hand and rubbed his nose against it. I moved my hand a little, and the snake moved to it and touched his nose to the flesh again. He moved a bit more and commenced to rub the underside of his jaw on top of my hand. From the corner of my eye, I saw another snake on my left shoulder. He was motionless and limp. I could not tell if he was dead or merely asleep. Whatever the case, I did not want him there, and I began to swing my body gently from side to side on the bone axle. The movement caused the serpent to roll over with his white belly up, and I gave my shoulder a shake, and he fell into the darkness below. I felt a sting, and I saw the little snake pulling his head away from my hand, an amber drop of venom on his mouth. He had bitten me. The hand was already well along to being dead numb from the cramped position, and I hardly felt it. It was on the order of a horsefly bite. I counted myself lucky the snake was small. That was how much I knew of natural history. People who know tell me the younger snakes carry the more potent poison, and that it weakens with age. I believe what they say. Now here came Rooster with a rope looped around his waist and his feet against the sides of the pit, descending in great violent leaps and sending another shower of rocks and dust down on me. He landed with a heavy bump, and then it seemed he was doing everything at once. He grasped the collar of my coat and shirt behind my neck and heaved me up from the hole with one hand, at the same time kicking at snakes and shooting at them with his belt revolver. The noise was deafening and made my head ache. My legs were wobbly. I could hardly stand. Rooster said,
Can you hold to my neck?
I said, Yes, I will try. There were two dark red holes in his face, with dried rivulets of blood under them where shotgun pellets had struck him. He stooped down, and I wrapped my right arm around his neck and lay against his back. He tried to climb the rope, hand over hand, with his feet against the sides of the pit, but he made only about three pulls and had to drop back down. Our combined weight was too much for him. His right shoulder was torn from a bullet, too, although I did not know it at the time. "Stay behind me," he said, kicking and stomping the snakes while he reloaded his pistol. A big grandfather snake coiled himself around Rooster's boot and got his head shot off for his boldness. Rooster said, "Do you think you can climb the rope?" "My arm is broken," said I, "and I am bit on the hand." He looked at the hand and pulled his dirk knife and cut the place to scarify it. He squeezed blood from it and took some smoking tobacco and hurriedly chewed it into a cud and rubbed it over the wound to draw the poison. Then he harnessed the rope tightly under my arms. He shouted up to the Texan, saying, "Take the rope, LaBeef. Maddie is hurt. I want you to pull her up in easy stages. Can you hear me?" LaBeef replied, "I will do what I can." The rope grew taut and lifted me to my toes. "Pull," shouted Rooster. "The girl is snake-bit, man, pull." But LaBeef could not do it, weakened as he was by his bad arm and broken head. "It's no use," he said. "I will try the horse." In a matter of minutes, he had fastened the rope to a pony. "I am ready," the Texan called down to us. "Take a good hold." "Go," said Rooster. He had looped the rope about his hips and once around his waist. He held me with the other arm. We were jerked from our feet. Now there was power at the other end. We went up in bounds. Rooster worked to keep us clear of the rough sides with his feet. We were skinned up a little. Sunlight and blue sky. I was so weak that I lay upon the ground and could not speak. I blinked my eyes to accommodate them to the brightness, and I saw that LaBeef was sitting with his bloody head in his hands and gasping from his labors in driving the horse. Then I saw the horse. It was Little Blackie. The scrub pony had saved us. My thought was, the stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner. Rooster tied the cud of tobacco on top of my hand with a rag. He said, "Can you walk?" "Yes, I think so," said I. He led me toward the horse, and when I had walked a few steps, I was overcome with nausea, and I dropped to my knees. When the sickness had passed, Rooster helped me along and placed me in the saddle astride Little Blackie. He bound my feet to the stirrups, and with another length of rope, he tied my waist to the saddle, front and back. Then he mounted behind me. He said to LaBeef, "I will send help as soon as I can. Don't wander off." I said, "We are not leaving him." Rooster said, "I must get you to a doctor, sis, or you are not going to make it." He said to LaBeef as an afterthought, "I am in your debt for that shot, pard." The Texan said nothing, and we left him there holding his head. I expect he was feeling pretty bad. Rooster spurred Blackie away, and the faithful pony stumbled and skidded down the steep and brushy hill where prudent horsemen led their mounts. The descent was dangerous, and particularly so with such a heavy burden as Blackie was carrying. There was no way to dodge all the limbs. Rooster lost his hat and never looked back. We galloped across the meadow where the smoky duel had lately occurred. My eyes were congested from nausea, and through a tearful haze I saw the dead horses and the bodies of the bandits. The pain in my arm became intense, and I commenced to cry, and the tears were blown back in streams around my cheeks. Once down from the mountains, we headed north, and I guessed we were aiming for Fort Smith.
Despite the load, Blackie held his head high and ran like the wind, perhaps sensing the urgency of the mission. Rooster spurred and whipped him without let. I soon passed away in a faint. When I regained my senses, I realized we had slowed. Heaving and choking for breath, Blackie was yet giving us all he had. I cannot say how many miles we had ridden full out. Poor lathered beast. Rooster whipped and whipped. "Stop," I said. "We must stop. He is played out." Rooster paid me no heed. Blackie was all in, and as he stumbled and made to stop, Rooster took his dirk knife and cut a brutal slash on the pony's withers. "Stop it, I cried. Little Blackie squealed and burst forth in a run under the stimulation of the pain. I wrestled for the reins, but Rooster slapped my hands away. I was crying and yelling. When Blackie slowed again, Rooster took salt from his pocket and rubbed the wound with it, and the pony leaped forward as before. In a very few minutes, this torture was mercifully ended. Blackie fell to the ground and died, his brave heart burst and mine broken. There never lived a nobler pony. No sooner were we down than Rooster was cutting me free. He ordered me to climb upon his back. I held fast around his neck with my right arm, and he supported my legs with his arms. Now Rooster himself began to run, or jog, as it were, under the load, and his breath came hard. Once more I lost my senses, and the next I knew I was being carried in his arms, and sweat drops from his brow and mustache were falling on my neck. I have no recollection of the stop at the Poteau River, where Rooster commandeered a wagon and a team of mules from a party of hunters at gunpoint. I do not mean to suggest the hunters were reluctant to lend their team in such an emergency, but Rooster was impatient of explanation, and he simply took the rig. Farther along the river, we called at the home of a wealthy Indian farmer named Cullen. He provided us with a buggy and a fast span of matched horses, and he also sent one of his sons along, mounted on a white pony, to lead the way. Night had fallen when we reached Fort Smith. We rode into town in a drizzle of cold rain. I remember being carried into the home of Dr. J. R. Medill, with Dr. Medill holding his hat over a coal oil lamp to keep the rain off the mantel. I was in a stupor for days. The broken bone was set, and an open splint was fixed along my forearm. My hand swelled and turned black, and then my wrist. On the third day, Dr. Medill gave me a sizable dose of morphine and amputated the arm just above the elbow with a little surgical saw. My mother and Lawyer Daggett sat at my side while this work was done. I very much admired my mother for sitting there and not flinching, as she was of a delicate temperament. She held my right hand and wept. I remained in the doctor's home for something over a week after the operation. Rooster called on me twice, but I was so sick and dopey that I made poor company. He had patches on his face where Dr. Medill had removed the shotgun balls. He told me the posse of marshals had found LaBeef, and that the officer had refused to leave the place until he had recovered the body of Tom Chaney. None of the marshals was anxious to go down in the pit, so LaBeef had them lower him on a rope. He did the job, though his vision was somewhat confounded from the blow on his head. At McAllister's, he was given such treatment as was available for the depression on his head, and from there, he left for Texas with the corpse of the man on whose trail he had camped for so long. I went home on a varnish train, lying flat on my back on a stretcher that was placed in the aisle of a coach. As I say, I was quite sick, and it was not until I had been home for a few days that I fully recovered my faculties. It came to me that I had not paid Rooster the balance of his money. I wrote a check for $75 and put it in an envelope and asked Lawyer Daggett to mail it to Rooster in care of the marshal's office. Lawyer Daggett interviewed me about it, and in the course of our conversation I learned something disturbing. It was this. The lawyer had blamed Rooster for taking me on the search for Tom Chaney and had roundly cursed him and threatened to prosecute him in a court action. I was upset on hearing it. I told Lawyer Daggett that Rooster was in no way to blame and was rather to be praised and commended for his grit. He had certainly saved my life. Whatever his adversaries, the railroads and steamboat companies, may have thought, Lawyer Daggett was a gentleman. And, on hearing the straight of the matter, he was embarrassed by his actions. He said he still considered the deputy marshal had acted with poor judgment, but in the circumstances was deserving an apology. He went to Fort Smith and personally delivered the $75 owing to him, and then presented him with a $200 check of his own, and asked him to accept his apology for the hard and unfair words he had spoken. I wrote Rooster a letter and invited him to visit us.
he replied with a short note that looked like one of his vouchers, saying he would try to stop by when next he took prisoners to Little Rock. I concluded he would not come, and I made plans to go there when I had the use of my legs. I was very curious to know how much he had realized, if anything, in the way of rewards for his destruction of Lucky Ned Pepper's robber band, and whether he had received news of LaBeef. I will say here that Judy was never recovered, nor was the second California gold piece. I kept the other one for years, until our house burned. We found no trace of it in the ashes. But I never got the chance to visit him. Not 3 weeks after we had returned from the winding Stair Mountains, Rooster found himself in trouble over a gun duel he fought in Fort Gibson, Cherokee Nation. He shot and killed Otis Wharton in the duel. Of course, Wharton was a convicted murderer and a fugitive from the gallows, but there was a stir about the manner of the shooting. Rooster shot two other men that were with Wharton and killed one of them. They must have been trash, or they would not have been in the company of the thug, but they were not wanted by the law at that time, and Rooster was criticized. He had many enemies. Pressure was brought, and Rooster made to surrender his federal badge. We knew nothing of it until it was over, and Rooster gone. He took his cat, General Price, and the widow Potter and her six children and went to San Antonio, Texas, where he found work as a range detective for a stockman's association. He did not marry the woman in Fort Smith, and I suppose they waited until they reached the Alamo City. From time to time, I got bits of news about him from Chen Lee, who did not hear directly, but only by rumor. Twice I wrote the Stockman's Association in San Antonio. The letters were not returned, but neither were they answered. When next I heard, Rooster had gone into the cattle business himself in a small way. Then, in the early 1890s, I learned he had abandoned the Potter woman and her brood and had gone north to Wyoming with a reckless character named Tom Smith, where they were hired by stock owners to terrorize thieves and people called nesters and grangers. It was a sorry business, I am told, and I fear Rooster did himself no credit there in what they called the Johnson County War. In late May of 1903, Little Frank sent me a cutting from the Commercial Appeal in Memphis. It was an advertisement for the Cole Younger and Frank James Wild West show that was coming to play in the Memphis Chicks baseball park. Down in the smaller type at the bottom of the notice, Little Frank had circled the following. He rode with Quantrill. He rode for Parker. Scourge of territorial outlaws and Texas cattle thieves for 25 years. Rooster Cogburn will amaze you with his skill and dash with the six-shooter and repeating rifle. Don't leave the ladies and little ones behind. Spectators can watch this unique exhibition in perfect safety. So, he was coming to Memphis. Little Frank had teased me and chaffed me over the years about Rooster, making out that he was my secret sweetheart. By sending this notice, he was having sport with me, as he thought. He had penciled a note on the cutting that said, "Skill and dash. It's not too late, Maddie." Little Frank loves fun at the other fellow's expense, and the more he thinks it tells on you, the better he loves it. We have always liked jokes in our family, and I think they are all right in their place. Victoria likes a good joke herself, so far as she can understand one. I have never held it against either one of them for leaving me at home to look after Mama, and they know it, for I have told them. I rode the train to Memphis by way of Little Rock, and had no trouble getting the conductors to honor my Rock Island pass. It belonged to a freight agent, and I was holding it against a small loan. I had thought to put up at a hotel instead of paying an immediate call on Little Frank, as I did not wish to hear his chaff before I had seen Rooster. I speculated on whether the marshal would recognize me. My thought was, a quarter of a century is a long time. As things turned out, I did not go to a hotel. When my train reached the Bluff City, I saw that the show train was on a siding there at the depot. I left my bag in the station and set off walking beside the circus coaches through crowds of horses and Indians and men dressed as cowboys and soldiers. I found Cole Younger and Frank James sitting in a Pullman car in their shirt sleeves. They were drinking Coca-Colas and fanning themselves. They were old men. I supposed Rooster must have aged a good deal, too. These old-timers had all fought together in the border strife under Quantrill's black standard, and afterwards led dangerous lives, and now this was all they were fit for, to show themselves to the public like strange wild beasts of the jungle. They claim Younger carried 14 bullets about in various portions of his flesh. He was a stout, florid man with a pleasant manner, and he rose to greet me. The waxy James remained in his seat and did not speak or remove his hat. Younger told me that Rooster had passed away a few days before, while the show was at Jonesboro, Arkansas. He had been in failing health for some months, suffering from a disorder he called night hoss, and the heat of the early summer had been too much for him. Younger reckoned his age at 68 years. There was no one to claim him, and they had buried him in the Confederate cemetery in Memphis, though his home was out of Osceola, Missouri. Younger spoke fondly of him. "We had some lively times," was one thing he said. I thanked the courteous old outlaw for his help, and said to James, "Keep your seat, trash," and took my leave. They think now it was Frank James who shot the bank officer in Northfield. As far as I know, that scoundrel never spent a night in jail, and there was Cole Younger, locked away 25 years in the Minnesota pen. I did not stay for the show, as I guessed it would be dusty and silly like all circuses. People grumbled about it when it was over, saying James did nothing more than wave his hat to the crowd, and that Younger did even less, it being a condition of his parole that he not exhibit himself. Little Frank took his two boys to see it, and they enjoyed the horses. I had Rooster's body removed to Dardanelle on the train. The railroads do not like to carry disinterred bodies in the summertime, but I got around paying the premium rate by having my correspondent bank in Memphis work the deed from that end, through a grocery wholesaler that did a volume freight business. He was reburied in our family plot. Rooster had a little CSA headstone coming to him, but it was so small that I put up another one beside it, a $65 slab of Batesville marble, inscribed, "Reuben Cogburn, 1835-1903, a resolute officer of Parker's Court." People here in Dardanelle and Russellville said, "Well, she hardly knew the man, but it is just like a cranky old maid to do a stunt like that." I know what they said, even if they would not say it to my face. People love to talk. They love to slander you if you have any substance. They say I love nothing but money and the Presbyterian Church, and that is why I never married. They think everybody is dying to get married. It is true that I love my church and my bank. What is wrong with that? I will tell you a secret. Those same people talk mighty nice when they come in to get a crop loan or beg a mortgage extension. I never had the time to get married, but it is nobody's business if I am married or not married. I care nothing for what they say. I would marry an ugly baboon if I wanted to and make him cashier. I never had the time to fool with it. A woman with brains and a frank tongue and one sleeve pinned up and an invalid mother to care for is at some disadvantage, although I will say I could have had 2 or 3 old untidy men around here who had their eyes fastened on my bank. No, thank you. It might surprise you to know their names. I heard nothing more of the Texas officer, LaBeef. If he is yet alive and should happen to read these pages, I will be pleased to hear from him. I judge he is in his 70s now, and nearer 80 than 70. I expect some of the starch has gone out of that cowlick. Time just gets away from us. This ends my true account of how I avenged Frank Ross's blood over in the Choctaw Nation when snow was on the ground.
The End. You've been listening to True Grit by Charles Portis, narrated by Donna Tartt. We conclude this book with an essay by Donna Tartt.
It's a commonplace to say that we love a book, but when we say it, we really mean all sorts of things. Sometimes we mean only that we have read a book once and enjoyed it. Sometimes we mean that a book was important to us in our youth, though we haven't picked it up in years. Sometimes what we love is an impressionistic idea glimpsed from afar, as opposed to the experience of wallowing and plowing through an actual text. And all too often, people claim to love books they haven't read at all. Then, there are the books we love so much that we read them every year or two, and know passages of them by heart, that cheer us when we are sick or sad, and never fail to amuse us when we take them up at random, that we press on all our friends and acquaintances, and to which we return again and again with undimmed enthusiasm over the course of a lifetime. I think it goes without saying that most books that engage readers on this very high level are masterpieces, and this is why I believe that True Grit by Charles Portis is a masterpiece. Not only have I loved True Grit since I was a child, it is a book loved passionately by my entire family. I cannot think of another novel, any novel, which is so delightful to so many disparate age groups and literary tastes. Four generations of us fell for it in a swift coup de foudre, starting with my mother's grandmother, then in her early 80s, who borrowed it from the library and adored it and passed it along to my mother. My mother, her eldest granddaughter, was suspicious. There wasn't much overlap in their reading matter. My gentle great-grandmother, born in 1890, was the product of an extremely sheltered life and a more innocent creature in many respects than our most six-year-olds today, whereas my mother, in her 20s then, kept books like The Boston Strangler on her bedside table. Purely from a sense of duty, she gave True Grit a try, and was so crazy about it that when she finished it, she turned back to the first page and read it all over again. My own middle-aged grandmother, whose reading habits were rather severe, running to politics and science and history, was smitten by True Grit, too, which was even more remarkable since, apart from the classics of her childhood and what she called the great books, she didn't even care all that much for fiction. I think she might have been the person who suggested that it be given to me to read. And I was only about 10, but I loved it too, and I've loved it ever since. The plot of True Grit is uncomplicated and as pure in its way as one of the Canterbury Tales. The opening paragraph sets up the premise of the novel elegantly and economically. People do not give it credence that a 14-year-old girl could leave home and go off in the wintertime to avenge her father's blood. But it did not seem so strange then, although I will say it did not happen every day. I was just 14 years of age when a coward going by the name of Tom Cheney shot my father down in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and robbed him of his life and his horse and $150 in cash money, plus two California gold pieces that he carried in his trouser band. The speaker is Mattie Ross, from Yale County, near Dardanelle, Arkansas, and the time is the 1870s, shortly after the Civil War. Mattie leaves her grief-stricken mother at home with her younger siblings and sets out after Tom Cheney, the hired man who has killed her father. But Cheney has joined up with a band of outlaws, the Lucky Ned Pepper Gang, and ridden out into the Indian Territory, which is under the jurisdiction of U.S. Marshals. Mattie wants someone to go after him, and she wants someone who will shoot first and ask questions later. So she asks the sheriff in Fort Smith for the name of the best marshal he knows. The sheriff thought on it for a minute. He said,
I would have to weigh that proposition. There's near about 200 of them. I reckon William